Chapter 2. The White Race, Nature's Greatest Miracle. If there is one thing in this wonderful world of ours that is worth preserving, defending, and promoting, it is the white race. Nature looked fondly upon the white race, and lavished special loving care in its growth. Of all the millions of creatures who have inhabited the face of this planet over the eons of time, none has ever quite equaled that of the white race. Nature endowed her elite with a greater abundance of intelligence and creativity, of energy and productivity, than she endowed upon any other creature, now or in the millenniums past. It has been the white race who has been the world builder, the makers of cities and commerce and continents. It is the white man who is the sole builder of civilizations. It was he who built the Egyptian civilization, the great unsurpassed Roman civilization, the Greek civilization of beauty and culture, and who, after being dealt a serious blow by a new Semitic religion, wallowed through the Dark Ages, finally extricated himself, and then built the great European civilization. These European white men, then, with civilization in their blood and in their destiny, crossed the Atlantic and set up a new civilization on a bleak and rock-bound coast. It was the white men who drove north to Alaska and west to California, the men who opened up the tropics and subdued the Arctics, the men who mastered the African velds, the men who peopled Australia and seized the gates of the world at Suez, Gibraltar, and Panama. It was the white race who produced men like Columbus who crossed the unknown Atlantic. Men like Magellan who first circumnavigated the globe. Men like Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, Rembrandt, Velázquez, Bernini, Rubens, Raphael, and thousands of other geniuses who created beautiful and exquisite productions in the fields of sculpture and painting. Geniuses like Beethoven, Bach, Wagner, and Verdi who created beautiful music. Men like James Watt who invented the steam engine. Men like Daimler who invented and built the reciprocating internal combustion engine. Production geniuses like Henry Ford. Inventors like Thomas Edison, such a prodigal genius as Nikola Tesla in the field of physics and electricity, literary geniuses like Shakespeare, Goethe, and thousands of others, untold geniuses in the field of mathematics, in the field of chemistry and physics. It was the white man who spanned the continents of the world with railroads and superhighways and electrical power lines. It was the white man who created the miraculous world of electronics, ushering in the telephone, the radio, and television. It was the white race who, in a combined burst of energy and genius, sent rockets to the moon and planted the feet of the white man on the extraterrestrial territory in the last decade. The brilliant accomplishments of the white race are endless and rapidly expanding, even as this is being written. All one has to do is leaf through the pages of an encyclopedia to appreciate the magnificent legacy of achievements wrought by the white race through the centuries. What other race can even come close to this remarkable record of creativity, achievement, and productivity? The answer is none. None whatsoever. None can even come close. In contrast, the black man of Africa never so much as even invented the wheel. Yes, it is the white man, with his inborn and inbred genius, that has given form to every government and livelihood to every other people, and above all, great ideals to every century. Yes, we are the ones, racial comrades, who were especially endowed by nature and chosen to be the ruling elite of the world. Indeed, we were chosen by nature to be masters of the world, by building it ever better and better. We were destined to be fruitful and to multiply and to inhabit the entire hospitable face of this planet. This is our manifest destiny, as ordained by nature herself. We, the white race, have such a glorious heritage and such an illustrious history that every member of the white race should be bursting with pride to be a part of it. Each and every one of us must dedicate ourselves to the great mission that nature has set for us, but have not yet fulfilled, namely, to rule and to populate all the good earth of this planet. It is not my objective here to retrace the history of the white race in these few pages, nor is it my purpose to make a scientific study of the races of mankind. I want to show and remind my white racial comrades of something that, at this time in history, they are sadly unaware of: the greatness of our history in the past, the noble mission that nature has set for us in the future. Also, I want to set forth in stark profile the danger that we are now in, and the enemies that are determined to engulf and destroy us. When we reflect on the source of all our knowledge, we find that the only real truths are in nature and in nature's laws. All that we know is rooted in the natural laws that surround us. It is the white man's uncanny ability to observe, to reason, and to organize his knowledge of that small part of nature's secrets from which he has lifted the veil. One of the first major observations man has made is that nature is governed by law. The laws of nature are unchanging, unbending, and unyielding. They are eternal. One of the inexorable laws of nature is the survival of the fittest. We have seen from the previous chapter that nature is continually striving to upgrade each of the species by dividing them into subspecies and having each one of the subspecies compete against each other. Those who cannot compete fall by the wayside and forever fade into oblivion. Those that are superior prosper and multiply. Nowhere in nature do we see the superior fleeing before the inferior, nor do we observe where the superior charitably tries to help sustain or uplift an inferior species. Nature evidently wishes the inner segregation of the species. For instance, if we look at the bird kingdom, we find that hummingbirds have been segregated into some 320 different species. Sparrows have been segregated into 263 species, wrens into over 60 species, and so on. In the animal kingdom, we find the same phenomenon being revealed before our eyes. Whether we look at the species of mice, or rabbits, or cats in their natural habitat, we find that they have been segregated into dozens of different species, each following its own pattern for its survival, propagation, and multiplication in competition with its own subspecies and the other creatures of the earth. Each has its peculiar means of protection, of mating, of propagation. Each has its natural enemies. Man, too, is a creation of and a creature of nature. He, too, has been endowed by nature with a special program for survival and propagation. He, too, has his natural enemies, and it is a cold, hard fact of nature that the white man's most deadly enemies are other species of mankind, namely the Jews and other colored races. We further observe about nature that she abhors mongrelization and bastardization. Nowhere in nature's natural kingdom do we find a fraternization or mongrelization of the different species, nor do we find them interbreeding and mixing their genes. Not only do we find that the different species of birds, for instance, do not interbreed, but we find that the subspecies do not interbreed, although they may live in the same forest or in the same environment. For instance, we do not find crows, who are birds, mating with white egrets, who are also birds. We do not even find that any of the species of wren mix or interbreed with each other. Nor do we find any interbreeding among the different subspecies of the jay. For instance, a blue jay will not mate with a gray jay, or a Mexican jay, or a Stella's jay, or a scrap jay, or a green jay. If this were not one of the prime objectives and laws of nature, we would soon find that not only would all the species be mongrelized into one species, but all the birds would be mongrelized into one type of bird only, and all the fish, with all their thousands and thousands of species, would be mongrelized into one type of fish. There would soon be no such thing as a beautiful blue jay, or a beautiful cardinal, or a wonderful little hummingbird, or a delightful meadow lark. No. The black bear and the grizzly bear may live in the same forest, but they do not commune with each other, nor do they socialize with each other, nor do they mongrelize or mate with each other. This is one of the inexorable laws of nature. Nature frowns upon bastards and usually punishes them by extinction. The species of mankind, too, has been endowed with a natural instinct to segregate, mate, and socialize only with its own narrow subspecies. Each has a natural instinct to preserve its own kind by protecting it, fighting for it, and defending it against all other races which it deems hostile to its own. Despite all the Jewish propaganda we have been inoculated with, this instinct is still there. All this false, unnatural propaganda may heap such derogatory terms as racist, bigot, etc. upon its victims, but the fact still remains that the white race prefers to live, socialize with, and marry within its own kind. The Chinese among their own kind, the blacks among theirs, and so on. The fact that the color line is being broken down. Mongrelization is taking place and has taken place. It is an abomination against nature. It is unnatural, and nature does not wait long to heap retribution upon those who violate her laws. Unfortunately, the white race, which has the most to lose, has in its past history been most criminally careless in safeguarding that most precious gift endowed by nature in its genes. Where it has been so marvelously illustrious in learning the laws of physics, botany, zoology, and technology, it has for some strange reason been most criminally blind and careless in applying those laws of genetics in its own propagation for its own preservation. Whereas the white man nurtures proudly the thoroughbred breeding of horses, dogs, and cats, he is strangely blind about his own breeding. He still does not seem to have fully grasped that nature always extinguishes those forms of life which fail to abide by her laws. In the 20th century, the race issue is becoming overwhelmingly clear and ominous. It will soon become impossible to confuse it with semantics, or economic theories, or Marxist jargon, or humanitarian garbage, or religious double talk. The issue will soon be so sharp that the final choice will be overwhelmingly obvious. However, as this is being written, most of the white people of America and elsewhere are still most tragically confused and sadly deluded. They seem to be stricken with a strange blindness about the race issue, a blindness that is almost criminally insane. It is the purpose of the following pages to briefly look into the white man's history and throw a glaring spotlight upon the crimes and errors he has committed in not safeguarding the purity of his blood. Whereas, at any time in history, it is dangerous to make an accurate prediction of the future, it is especially so regarding anything that pertains to the white race. Contradicting all the obnoxious and erroneous ideals about race that have been implanted into the minds of the mob, and despite all the delusions now prevalent, I will nevertheless make the following prediction. The white race will either rally and unite in the very near future and possess for its very own the strategic idea of winning the world for its own peoples, or it will be miserably and savagely destroyed by the colored peoples of the world. We must now either make this planet forever secure for our race, or miserably perish. We must either populate all the continents with our own, or be overrun by the inferior coloreds. One of the truisms of contemporary history is the fact that those whites who know least about the niggers and have the least amount of contact with them always seem to bear against those whites who are thrown in contact with the niggers, an unreasonable hatred. Such insanity against their own white brothers is unnatural, contrary to their innermost natural instincts, and artificially planted by the diabolically cunning propaganda of the perfidious Jew. Without a doubt, the most difficult obstacle in the white man's struggle to save himself from destruction and mongrelization by the colored races is the strange and perverted attitude of the white man towards himself. The main problem now is not overcoming the Jews or the blacks, but strictly a matter of straightening out the white man's thinking. Throughout this book, I am going to use the non-scientific term, the white race, and for good reasons. I am well aware of the fact that various anthropologists have divided, subdivided, and classified, and reclassified the white race into many branches and sub-branches. I am well aware of some arbitrary major subdivisions as Aryan or Nordic, Mediterranean, and Alpine. These are then reclassified into a multitude of further branches and mixtures. Purposely, I am avoiding this whole hassle like the plague. To here use anthropological divisions and subdivisions is to fall into a vicious Jewish trap. To even use the word Nordic or Aryan in this book is highly divisive. This book was not designed to start the white people arguing amongst themselves, but to unite the whole white race in the battle against the Jews in particular and all the colored races in general. Therefore, the term white race is broad enough to encompass all the good members of our race, without nitpicking as to which branches are best or who belongs where. I am well aware that the white race has some mongrelized fringes. It has many mixtures in its own inner groups, such as Nordic mixed with Alpine, Alpine with Mediterranean, etc. However, it serves no purpose whatsoever to differentiate and create caste systems within the white race itself. On the contrary, it would be highly destructive and divisive. Even to use the term Aryan would be harmful to our creed, since this term, too, is widely misunderstood by most members of the white race itself. To most Americans, this term would relate, although incorrectly, to Germans only, and something that belonged to Hitler's movement. Although Hitler was undoubtedly a great white leader, this term, nevertheless, would be an obstacle rather than an aid in uniting the white race and promoting our new religion. Our first objective in this battle is, and must be, to unite the white man and straighten out his thinking. United and organized, the white race is 10 times as powerful as the rest of the world combined. Once we have done this, the Jew and nigger problem is as good as solved. Once we are again in control of our own destiny, then we can proceed with more meaningful programs in advancing and upgrading our own race. This can easily be done without coercive methods. We can accomplish this by promoting and encouraging the reproduction of the better elements among the white race and discouraging the lesser elements. As explained in more detail in Commandment number 12, this can easily be done through education, financial encouragement, religious creed, and several other methods without the necessity of using coercion. In any case, to unite the white race and win the coming battle against the Jews and the colored, we must rally the white race. We must unite and we must organize. For this reason, the term white race will be used throughout this book and in our religion. On this broad base, we can unite all the good members of our race rather than divide and fragment them into divisive and confusing technical terms. Having laid these ground rules, we are going to take a brief look at the history of our race and see what we can learn from it. We hope to do this so that we may prevent in the future those disastrous mistakes we have made in the past. In reviewing the long history of the white race and white civilizations in contact with the colored races, especially the Negroid races, we see over and over again these lessons being hammered home to us. First, that the racial destruction of the white race is inescapable in time whenever there is substantial presence of a colored race amongst it. And secondly, that civilization itself never survives the destruction of the white race, even where its civilization has been implanted for thousands of years. This, in essence, puts in a nutshell the greatest problem that the white race has ever faced and faces today. Today, more than ever before, with ever-increasing rapidity, the choice is being presented to us in cold and stark outline, namely, the continuation of our present human level and also the possibility of further evolution to even higher planes, or, on the other hand, devolution, retrogression, mongrelization, and finally, utter decay. The fact is that for the white man, it is not even going to be a slow and gradual retrogression, but one that will flare into a horrible massacre that will make the slaughter of the 20 million white Russians by the Jews pale into insignificance. One thing is certain, the white race will either unite and fight for its survival soon, or it will be exterminated. This is a certainty from which the white man cannot flee. The Jew has done too thorough a job of inflaming the colored races of the world with hatred of the white race, just waiting for the time and opportunity to make the big kill. Madison Grant, in his classic, The Passing of the Great Race, put it this way in regards to the race situation in America. If the purity of the two races is to be maintained, they cannot continue to live side by side. And this is a problem from which there can be no escape. Alexis de Tocqueville phrased it this way, "There are only two alternatives for the future of the Negroes and the whites. They must either wholly part or wholly mingle." The Jews have misquoted Thomas Edison most criminally in his famous passage by quoting only half of it and leaving off the rest of it. Even on the Jefferson Memorial in Washington. Here is what Jefferson said. "Nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people are to be free, nor is it less certain that the two races, equally free, cannot live in the same government." The last part the Jewish press suppresses. The history of the world is a never-ending history of racial movement and migration. Great people wanderings are the warp and woof of history. The fact is historic and prehistoric. However, We are not particularly interested at this point about the wanderings of the Turks or the Magyars, or how the Indians crossed the Bering Strait and came to inhabit America. We are here primarily interested in the history of the white race, the civilizations it has created throughout the world, and how the white man failed miserably in preserving the purity of his blood, how he was submerged and diluted among the inferior races which he had conquered and partially civilized, how he lost his identity, lost his culture, and indeed lost the hard-won civilization which he had created. The white race conquered and civilized India, Persia, and Greece. This is well known. Not so well known is the fact that he also invaded the islands of Japan and created a civilization there, and also entered into, conquered, and created a great civilization in China approximately 4,000 years ago. Let us now look at the first great white civilization in that cradle of civilization in the delta of the Nile. Here, due to unusual climate conditions and the sands of the Nile, have been preserved so many artifacts, monuments, and creative archaeological treasures that the history of Egypt can be read like an open book, stretching back as far as 6,000 years of their exciting history. Furthermore, Egypt offers a classical lesson in history for us to study the contacts between the culture-creating, energetic white race and the Negroid masses immediately to the south of it, with whom the Egyptians were continually intermingling. From the time of the consolidation of the kingdoms of Upper and Lower Egypt by Menes, 3400 BC, to the final decay and overthrow of the kingdom of the pharaohs, is a period of approximately 3,000 years, and this period is divided into possibly 30 dynasties. Between the ascent of Menes to the throne of Egypt as the first pharaoh at approximately 3,400 BC, and the ascent of Tehaka, Amulato, to that same throne in 688 BC, we see the span of Egyptian history unraveled from the first great heights it achieved to its mongrelization and slow decay and final stagnation from which it never recovered. We can regard the ascent of Tehaka as the death and the end of Egyptian civilization. However, this white civilization did last for almost 3,000 years, and that is a long time. We can learn from this span a great deal about the genius of the white man and the results of blood poisoning that occur when he is in contact with the Negroid race. The one thing we see in the survey of this ancient civilization is that its great achievements were in the earlier centuries, that is, when the white race was still pure. There was a prolonged period of decline. The inhabitants lost initiative and ingenuity. When the Assyrians came, the Egyptians could offer but feeble resistance. We can best understand this situation if we grasp the fact that Egyptian civilization was not overthrown. It was mongrelized and it decayed like a rotten apple. The trouble was internal. It was in the poisoning of its blood by intermingling with the blacks. Already in the 43rd century BC, the men of the Delta, who were white, had discovered the year of 365 days, and they introduced a calendar of this length. It was the civilization of the Delta, therefore, that furnished us with the earliest fixed dates in the history of the world. It was the northern kingdom of the Delta region, farthest removed from the Nubians to the south, and in close contact with other white peoples of North Africa and Asia Minor, that was the most advanced. At the time of the consolidation of the upper and lower kingdoms under Mens, in 3400 BC, the kingdoms of the north and the south were expanded. Of this time, Breasted, in his History of Egypt, says that Mens, the first pharaoh, carried his arms southward against northern Nubia, which then extended below the first cataract, as far northward as the Nome of Edfu, and built a dam above the city of Memphis to divert the waters of the Nile, to gain more room for that city. The swamplands of the delta were being reclaimed as before the consolidation of the two kingdoms, and the rich lands obtained drew to the delta a rapidly increasing population. So we see that the first pharaoh reigned over a people already able to divert the waters of the Nile, reclaim the swampland of the delta, and important to our consideration, to wage warfare against the Negroid peoples of Nubia. In addition to these attainments, the people under the first pharaoh are known to have used not only the hieroglyphic, but a cursive hand as well, and thus have to its credit the invention and the use of alphabetic signs at least 2,500 years earlier than any other people. The second dynasty erected stone temples. Nemar, an early king, took 120,000 Libyans captive and their herds. 1,420,000 small and 4,000 large cattle. There is evidence that the kings of this time maintained foreign relationships with far remote peoples, and that they were in commercial relations with the peoples of the northern Mediterranean in the 4th millennium BC. The 3rd to the 6th dynasties, inclusive, have formed the period known as the Old Kingdom, and encompassed the time span from 2928 to 2475 BC. In religion, government, society, industry, and art, the Old Kingdom is revealed as a well-constituted state, exhibiting rapidly developing culture, physical and spiritual, superior to the culture of the dynasties to follow. The Egyptians were a religious people, who at this remote date devoutly believed in the resurrection of the body after death, and in the immortality of the soul. Osiris was their god of the dead, king of the glorified. Of a just man, they said, as Osiris lives, so shall he live. As Osiris died not, so shall he also not die. As Osiris perished not, so shall he also not perish. They believe that a praying man would soon roll the departed to the land of the glorified, but that this praying man would receive only those of whom it was said, "There is no evil which he has done." This is the earliest record of an ethical test at the close of life, making the life after dependent upon the moral quality of the life lived in this world. The animal worship, which is usually associated with ancient Egypt as a cult, is a later product brought forward in the decline of that nation as it became more intermingled and mongrelized with the blacks, bringing about a decline in its religion at the tragic closing of its history. Not only were the ancient Egyptians highly advanced in their spiritual conception, but they had also achieved a surprisingly high level in their social and material culture as well. Within the home, the wife was in every respect the equal of the husband, and was treated as such. Affection among the immediate brothers and sisters, and obedience to their parents, was religiously taught to all youths. A favorite inscription upon a tomb was, "I was one beloved of his father, praised of his mother, whom his brothers and sisters loved." Probably the most outstanding achievement of the early Egyptians was their use of metal tools, which date back to such early times that some authorities claim that Egyptians initiated the age of metals. We can hardly overestimate the importance of this step in the history of man. Prior to the invention of metal implements, the tools used in the industries and arts were those made from stone, reeds, and bones. This placed a tremendous limitation upon the advancement of any people or nature so handicapped. With the use of metals, however, industry could take a rapid course in war, as well as in the arts of peace. We owe, therefore, to Egypt a great debt for the contributions to the progress of mankind, and not the least of these was their invention of the use of metal tools. With their creative genius awakened, and conscious of their constructive talent, the Egyptians sought yet greater triumphs. As the dynasties followed each other, and the pharaohs reigned and died, these hardy individuals wished to build for themselves imperishable monuments to their power. This desire to live, in the eyes of posterity, gradually found expression in the pyramid tomb. Each succeeding pharaoh, viewing the tombs of his predecessors, would wish for a yet greater expression of his power and his glory in the building of an ever larger pyramid. And so the age of mighty pyramids was ushered in. These are undoubtedly the most conspicuous evidence of Egyptian greatness, and in the ability of the engineers in planning and overseeing, and the organized power of the pharaohs in bringing them to perfection, we catch a glimpse of the white civilizers of Egypt, which must further impress us with the magnitude of their power. Zoser, the first pharaoh of the Old Kingdom, made his capital at Memphis. It was the Old Kingdom in which art and mechanics reached a level of unprecedented excellence never later surpassed. With Zoser, as with Menes, 3400 BC, we have a record of the extension of the Egyptian influence over the mulatto tribes of Nubia. During the reign of Zoser, Egyptian conquest had quelled the turbulent mongrel tribes of northern Nubia, and peaceful navigation of the Nile was possible for a distance of 75 miles south of the first cataract. From Menes to Zoser intervened more than 400 years. Within these four centuries, the southern frontier had been extended but little. Sesostris III of the 12th dynasty, who came to the throne in 1887 BC, completed the conquest of Nubia. Between Menes and Sesostris III, there is a period of 1,500 years. This evidence of the slow conquest and absorption of the Negroids to the south of Egypt is worthy of our attention. These centuries covered the period of Egypt's greatness. Egypt was still white. Before the time of Zoser, the royal tombs were constructed of sun-dried brick. However, with the arrival of Zoser, who, desiring a more permanent memorial for himself, built a terraced pyramid of stone 195 feet in height, he became the first pyramid builder. Later kings of this dynasty erected the great pyramids of Dashur and Sneferu, and the last king constructed vessels of 170 feet long for traffic on the Nile. Across the Nile from modern Cairo, which was ancient Giza, the tourists who visit Egypt today will get their first glimpse of the might and power of the civilization that has perished. They can see, among others, the great pyramid built by Khufu, Cheops. To properly appreciate how strong and effective must have been the organization of Khufu's government, we must realize that this pyramid contains some 2,300,000 blocks, each weighing on the average 2.5 tons. Furthermore, the sculpture of the Old Kingdom exhibits the highest technical skill and compares favorably with the work of modern artists. Egypt, at the close of the 4th millennium BC, had solved the fundamental problems of great architecture, developing with the most refined artistic sense and the greatest mechanical skill the treatment of voids. The art of weaving was also highly developed, so much so that their fabrics are a source of wonder to the modern beholder, while the goldsmiths were capable of producing the most exquisite ornaments, many of which have survived to the present day. Towards the close of the Old Kingdom, that is around 2475 BC, there is evidence of the weakening of the central power. But Egyptian culture did not suffer. Race is more than politics, religion, or art. These are but expressions of race. The six dynasties, the last of the Old Kingdom, marks a foreign policy of increasing vigor. The Negro tribes of the south were compelled to contribute quotas to the Egyptian army, and the use of these levies against the white neighbors with whom the Egyptians were at war marks an unsavory epoch in the history of the contact of races. The non-creative black races, compelled to rely upon their own resources in war or peace, are insignificant competitors with the white man. But armed with the white man's inventions, they are transformed into formidable competitors, immediately attaining rank which evolutionary forces have not conferred upon them, and assuming an influence which they are incapable of maintaining. The pharaoh's use of multitudes of Negro troops against the enemies of Egypt had much to do with the final decay of Egyptian civilization. In it we see the seed leading to its final decay. Let us now proceed approximately another 2,000 years in the history of Egypt, in the search for light upon the Egyptian Negro problem. This will bring us approximately to the year 1500 BC. Astonishingly, we find the Negro policy of the Egyptian Empire of this time not to be radically different from that of the white nations now ruling Africa. Egyptian temples had now sprung up at every large town, and the Egyptian gods were worshipped therein. The Egyptians' arts were learnt by Nubian craftsmen, and everywhere the rude barbarism of the Upper Nile, which was black territory, was receiving the stamp of Egyptian culture. Nevertheless, the native chieftains, under the surveillance of the viceroys, were still permitted to retain their titles and honors, and doubtless continued to enjoy at least a nominal share in the government. The annual landing of the viceroy of Thebes, who was black, and the bringing of the yearly tribute from all the Nubian lands was now a long-established custom in Egypt. The gradual diffusion of white culture and the utilization of native chiefs under the direction of white colonial governors was characteristic of the first attempt to implant civilization in Negroid Africa, as it is of the present effort on the part of modern white nations. The earliest period of Egyptian history reveals only a very slight Negroid mixture in the population of southern Egypt, and Egyptian art, civilization, and culture flourished. At the period we are now considering, namely 1500 BC, That is no way in which we can possibly tell the exact extension of Negro blood. But as Egyptians were constantly going into the south, and peoples from the south constantly coming into Egypt proper, it is not likely that more than half of the population of the southern half of Egypt was still white. Blood admixture has without exception been the inevitable result of long-continued race contact. From prehistoric times, the Negro had sifted into the country. Many thousands came as soldiers for the pharaohs of old. Countless numbers had come as slaves, many included in the yearly tribute of the southern dependencies, others as captives taken in war. While the large levies for purposes of labor, even though they were not necessarily kept by Egyptian authorities, would find that the Egyptian environment was better than their own squalid settlements, and decided to remain in Egypt. The Egyptians were not entirely unaware of the degenerating influence of the blacks among their civilization. Certain of the pharaohs tried to prevent the mongrelization of Egypt by restricting Negro immigration, even to the extent of inflicting the death penalty upon the immigrant. But the Negro was a docile, subservient workman and soldier, and these characteristics created a demand to the influence of which less enlightened pharaohs succumbed. So they came for centuries, not by force of arms and battle array, but as subjected and enslaved people. With the result of all this mongrelization, we now arrive at the end of the line. In the 25th dynasty, in the year 688 BC, the ascent of Tahaka, a mulatto, to the throne of once proud Egypt, marked for all practical purposes the end of Egyptian civilization. Tahaka was the son of a Nubian woman, and his features, as preserved in the contemporary sculpture, show unmistakably Negroid characteristics. As the mulatto inherited the throne of the once powerful pharaohs, his sister became the divine head of Egyptian religion, which in these centuries had become so grossly debased that the mulatto king's Nubian mother became a queen mother before whom all bowed down. For a period prior to the ascent of the mulatto pharaoh, Tahaka, the civilization of Egypt had become stagnant, while those dynasties succeeding Tahaka's reign were imposed by foreigners, who were now easy conquerors of Egypt. And so ends tragically a once proud and beautiful civilization. We have many lessons to learn from the degradation and decay of Egypt, lessons that evidently have not penetrated our minds even to this day. Yet the lessons are clear and they are plain. One of the lessons that we can learn is that a civilization can live for thousands of years. In fact, there is no reason why it cannot live forever if the blood of its creators remains pure and uncontaminated. Secondly, we learn that no matter what civil or religious laws are inaugurated, the very presence of the black race in contact with the white race will produce mongrelization, and mongrelization will inevitably result in the destruction and decay of that civilization. We also see that the nigger, who makes a docile and pliable slave, is a temptation that the aggressive but short-lived white overlords have found impossible to resist for use as cheap labor. It is this very characteristic of the nigger, the fact that he makes a docile and easy manageable slave, that has made him the deadly conqueror of the white race wherever this poison was so conveniently but short-sightedly put to use. We must also learn that no enforcement of civil laws, of social taboos, of religious practices, or any other practice yet conceived in the history of mankind has been able to prevent the mongrelization of the white race when it had the black, non-creative race in its midst. We can quite succinctly sum up the whole moral of Egyptian history in saying that there is no way in the world that we can save ourselves from the destruction of the white racial plague other than by expelling them far from our shores as quickly as we possibly can. For the white people of America, the lesson is overwhelmingly plain. In fact, it screams to high heaven, we must ship the niggers from out of our midst back to Africa as soon as possible.